once the bond has been fully paid, that the bank pays the title deed and hands it over. And you can also opt for a bond as part of a contract. But anyway, that was just by way of our deck. That was the best deck I ever had, and that's over and done. But let us get into the agenda. Thank you very much. It's good that the buses are now on time, although I know some of you assist other comrades because you're using motor cars. But thank you to everyone for being here this morning. And welcome back. Welcome back, Honourable William. We thought we'd lost you to China and you wanted to join the economy there. But you arrived back, thank you. I see nothing else to add to here. We need to focus on the bill, that is what we are doing. So on that particular note, can we please have someone to propose the adoption? Yes, Uncle William?
Chairperson, I would propose the adoption, as just the closing remarks seem to be rather long, so perhaps that's just a title. I don't know what that means. From 10:45 till 1 o'clock, it's closing remarks. So perhaps we should just amend that and then propose the adoption, because, you know, this is Parliament.
No, I mean, I have been known to speak for long, but really, this is exaggerating it, Mr. Herman, but I don't know if you were party to that era. Thank you. With that amendment, all right? And then seconded by... thank you, Honourable Laura Tierko. Can we please move to the apologies? I'm not aware of any myself. But look here, Mr. Hermans, you are so efficient. Right. Honourable Khadebi will be arriving late. Honourable Tierko will have to attend the PC on labour. Honourable Yesterhausen will start. He said he'll start here. I don't see him. All right. And then Honourable McPherson has party business, a by-election in KZN.
Yeah.
I wasn't aware of that. Right. So on that note, I think apologies are acceptable. Can we move on then? And just to indicate, the DDG of Consumer and Corporation Regulation Division, Dr. Masoccia is here, you're welcome. Is Mr. Sipamangla here?
Sorry, Chair, he's not yet here. I'm expecting him here, but if he's not here, I'll apologize when he's here.
All right, so he's just probably arriving late. Is the Director of Legal Drafting here, Ms. Matawani?
Also, it's in the same length.
Right. Is Ms. Matonzi, the regulatory impact assessment?
She's also not here yet.
Now, I can understand you cutting down on the accommodation. I welcome that sort of thing. And you hold the fort. The National Credit Regulator, Ms. Machigari, the CEO of the National Credit Regulator, is here. You're welcome. And the others are back. You're holding the fort here. Good. And then for the Constitutional and Legal Services, I know we've got the Advocate Van der Merwe. The National Consumer Tribunal, is Mr. Nombeta here? Oh, right, right in front of me. Chief Information Officer, and of course Mr. Moodley, the Deputy Registrar. And then I saw someone else here, or is it my iPad? I think I saw the legal person here, I mean the National Treasury. No, not next. Who else is here that we have not acknowledged?
He just came in now.
Members, we're going to go through this. You will recall, and just for the record, I'll ask Advocate Merwe just to list the five issues that were flagged last week, and then you'll start at the beginning. All right?
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, members. The
five planning issues. Problems outlined here from memory. Oh, here we go. The first flag issue was the, and it goes over more than one area, is as we have two streams of the intervention, a longer term stream and a short term stream, the question is whether the amount of $7,500 for the maximum gross income and the amount of $50,000 for the maximum total unsecured debt would still in 10 years be a valid amount. And the agreement of the committee was that no, it wouldn't, but the question was on how then to address that concern. So what we have at the moment is a proposal that the minister will prescribe and may adjust it, but that must happen with the commission of the assembly. So when we get to the regulation clause, I'll just highlight that again, and then we can decide if that is now what we have in mind. Because it seems that we are quite close to agreeing on it, but members just said that it must be flagged so that we don't lose that issue. And another issue of concern is I apologize for computers giving me a sense of a problem then. The other flag issue is the issue of when a credit provider does not supply the required information to a debt counsellor in order to enable that debt counsellor to determine whether agreement is reckless or not, whether that should be an offence. So that is an outstanding issue. There was also a concern about the issue of such information in that clause, and what we have done is there is in the regulation there's a list of documents that credit providers must keep when they do an affordability assessment. So we've simply said these documents are the things that must be provided. But the concern still is whether this should be an offence or whether we should start off with it being prohibited conduct that could be subject to an administrative fine. And if we then, after a period of time, see this is very problematic, then you make it an offence. Because members will recall that is what we're doing now in the set of registration offences and other prohibited conduct, where the fact of the administration fine simply has not been enough. So that is why we were making those an offence. So the question is, do we start with this opposite offence, or do we go the route of first having it as an administrative fine and then seeing if it is a problem later on? Another concern that is outstanding is the time period in which a consumer's right to apply for credit must be limited after the debt has been extinguished. We have drawn a map for members of the timelines that we will look at. When we get to that specific clause, I'll refer to the map and we can then have a discussion on that. The last matter that is a flag matter is the issue of regulation and whether there should be a prescribed format of debt intervention or whether it should only be possible by way of legislation. So what members will recall on that concern is that we received from National Treasury and from the DTI, opinions from legal counsel, who both have the view that the prescribed measures are unconstitutional because they provide too big a discretion to the minister. What they both indicate, or what the opinion from Treasury indicated, is that if we define significant exogenous shock and natural disaster, then it might pass muster because you can be clear in what the situation is. We have defined it. My concern with the definition is I don't think it really adds more to what we normally understand this to be. So, you know, it's almost a cosmetic thing that we're adding. My personal view is I think that we will pass constitutional muster with it as it is. The problem, however, is if you look at the whole process that we're putting in place, it almost nullifies the urgency that is the rationale for the regulations when there is a significant exogenous shock and when there is a natural disaster. Because the minister will have to consult, the minister will have to come here, so there is a process put in place. But I suppose the same argument goes for legislation, and on both processes we can be some fast-tracking. So those are the outstanding issues. Thank you.
Right, we're not having a debate on that, but other members have got a package in front of them, including a diagrammatic page. Thank you very much. So we're going to be led by yourself today, Advocate Vandermeer. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. If I can comprehend this through the bill, I think clause by clause. I'm not going to really focus on the long title of the bill at this stage, because it's not a voting process at this stage. It's more to get a final document that we can consult senior council on. The long title simply gives an extract of the most important points in the bill. In clause one, we're dealing with definitions. Now, I apologize, I think I started with a preamble because there were some changes there. So in the preamble, we make it very clear that what this bill addresses is in fact also a constitutional gap. In other words, it is not just that we are affecting the constitutional right to property. We are correcting a gap in practice currently where there are certain consumers who are unfairly discriminated against simply because they don't have money or assets. So we are making that quite clear in the preamble, specifically the third paragraph of the preamble. Then what we have also done in that specific clause, you'll see there's just a font in blue, just to change some grammatical things to make sure that we say also the economically viable client for a debt counsellor, it just reads a bit better. So there's not really much about that. If I can then start with clause one. Chair, shall I pause after each discussion? So should I pause after the preamble?
No. Unless I see a hand. Look, I'm looking at all of you. Unless I see a hand, we continue. Are they agreed? Thank you.
Thank you, Chief. Then what we have in section and clause one is that we remain in section one, which is your definitions clause. Members will recall that members of the public were saying, well, we need some definitions. Now we have this definition clause in the initial bill as well. But because our initial bill took this whole debt intervention measure and put it into a separate part, we included our definitions there because it would only be applicable to that part. But the criticism against draft five of the bill was that we weren't using existing measures. So what we've done is we have almost taken that part apart and we've slotted each of the steps into the act so that it flows logically. Anyone who looks at it can now see, oh, okay, this talks about the debt intervention, but I can see that it speaks to the debt review process just at a different level. Oh, this is a rearrangement, but I can see that it speaks to the debt intervention. So it puts them into the act so that it, there's a logical flow and it is clear to the public that existing measures are simply tweaked in order to make provision for these consumers. But because I've done that, I then brought all the definitions into section one of the Act. So we do define debt intervention. There was a call for that to be defined. It is a bit difficult, but so we've just defined it in relation to the specific section. And this is the fact that it aims to assist identify consumers for whom existing debt interventions are not accessible in practice. So very, very straightforward. The debt intervention applicant definition on the next page. So I'm now on page 4 of the bill. I just indicate there that I am not using this definition for the prescribed measure. The prescribed measure will have to do its own definition because the applicant could look a bit different. It could focus specifically on indigent people, could focus specifically on people earning up to $7,500, or it could focus specifically on people who were retrenched. So this definition is not made applicable to that. Debt intervention applicant is only applicable to the debt intervention measure in this bill. Anything that prescribed will have its own definition. So what we have there is we simply say it is a consumer under unsecured credit agreement, the income issue, we talked about the $7,500. then I just make here the note, but we'll talk about it when we get to the actual regulation clause. The fact that the 7,500 must be adjustable for the longer term measure, and that will be prescribed, but we'll deal with that under the 171(2), where we can actually see how the minister will prescribe it. If over-indebted, members will recall that was a big criticism. Mm-hmm. The fact that our bill does not make clear that these consumers must be over-indebted. It is now clearly included, and it is not normal to put examples in a definition, but there was some view expressed in the committee that we should perhaps say specific things so that it's clear what we are talking about. And then, of course, excluding anyone who is sequestered or already under administration order, because then other legal steps are in fact applicable to that person. Then there was also a concern about extinguish, because what was pointed out to the committee is that credit providers might find or have in the past in fact found loopholes where there is a decision that a contract, for instance, is rejected. Then fine, you can't enforce that contract, but then a credit provider institutes enrichment action against the consumer and say, well, you bought a car from me, it might have been rented, but you have a car, you've been enriched. Now, yes, it is good, those things must be considered on its own because there is an enrichment factor there. But for this specific consumer, what we have here, the extinguishing that we need, that the committee wanted to look at, is there must be no further plan. It must be the end of the whole thing. You can't have something go on again. So what we have is we made very clear that all rights and obligations in that agreement stop. I've used the word cessation. I've looked at other words, and unfortunately that one really says it's the best in legal terms. So, but it also stops any right or obligation that may arise in law, whether from statute or otherwise, and that otherwise covers the common law, even if there might be some indigenous law principles that I might not be aware of, it stops it at all, international law. So anything where you might have a right because your agreement was terminated, it is stopped. That right immediately stops if there is an extinguishing order. So, and then I just made it very clear that the extinguishing is prospective from the date of the order, so you can't extinguish it going backwards. Then the next two definitions, financial capability and over on page 5, financial advice.
If you could just clarify that point, advocate. You made the point that it is after the post. And at that point, everything is added up, looked at. This is the debt incurred in the past. That's the point I'm making. So although it stops there, it looks at what happened before.
Yes, Jean, exactly. The reason why I have the word prospective in there is that if we don't have an unfair situation in law where a debtor might say, oh, well, if it is extinguished as from the date of the agreement or of the date of the application, then there might be unintended consequences that we don't want. The idea is, because when will extinguishing come into play? It will come into play after 2 years of suspension. So that debt will then be extinguished as from the date of the order going forward. But it will look at the whole of the agreement up to the date of the order. And of course, the other thing is, when the debtor is rehabilitated, then we are saying that it is the debt up until the date of the order. So that is why it must be prospective, so that in law something does remain.
Thank you.
The next two definitions then, financial capability and financial literacy. This refers to the training that consumers must receive, and I received these definitions from National Treasury. They sent me something about the programming that Treasury is looking at, and these were the two things that they said we must make sure. The next definition of knowing, this is something to speak to our offense for non-natural people. So if you operate as a credit provider, but you're a non-natural, so it's a firm or a company, that must be still an offense for that company. You can't hide behind the company. But the concern was, oh, but what is the director now? What does knowing mean? So what I've simply done is I've gone back to the Companies Act where I bought the offence from in the first place, and I'm using the exact same definition that is used in the Companies Act. So in other words, it's a tried and tested definition, tried and tested offence. Then I've just inserted something there. I haven't discussed it with the committee before, but as I was amending based on the instructions received, I realized that we are using the word National Assembly in a number of clauses. So I've just defined National Assembly here, so that we don't have to continuously say the House referred to in section 42 of the Constitution. We just define it here, and then I can just use the term National Assembly throughout the bill. The last definition is then the definition of total unsecured debt. The big change here is that members wanted to make it very clear that the qualifying total unsecured debt, that $50,000, is only the principal debt. So whatever charges and interest are over $50,000, that's fine. As long as your principal debt is $50,000, you will qualify. So that was the purpose of that. Then the next clause, clause 2, we're amending section 3 of the Act. Now section 3 of the Act deals with the purpose of the Act. The purpose of the Act at this point in time does not provide for the state intervention measure. So we're simply inserting something in there to say providing appropriate debt intervention for qualifying consumers. So that was as per proposals from the public. So it was in a sense executing what the public proposed. The next clause, clause 3, inserts a new section into the Act. And the reason for that is, I've made some notes. You'll see that there are some clauses deleted. The clauses that I've deleted is just because we are no longer having a part. We're not inserting a part into the Act. If we inserted a part into the Act, I have to amend other sections that say this part applies to that and that part applies to this. Because we're now putting a part into the Act, I no longer have to amend those clauses. So it's simply deleting things that were consequential to start with and it's now no longer necessary. Then we have to go to clause 3. What we have in clause 3, we inserted section 15 into the Act. And the reason why we are inserting a new section is that there was a concern raised. We initially had it as part of section 15, which in the Act is the enforcement functions of the National Credit Regulator. And there was a concern that, but this is not an enforcement function. You should not really tie it with the enforcement functions of the regulator. Rather put it in a separate section. So that is what we've done here. The blue part there under subsection 1 paragraph C, it was just a drafting technicality. As I read through it again, I thought that we need to also add the prescribed measure to that. So what we simply say there is the national regulator must assist the debt intervention applicant with all of these processes that are associated with the debt intervention. Subsection 2 deals with capacitating the regulator in order for them to be able to execute these functions. The next clause, clause 4, section 27, is simply a consequential. Yes. Thank you, Honourable William.
Sorry, I'm still trying to read the capacitation of the National Credit Regulator because we're moving pretty fast. Can we just slow down a bit? She's going really fast with these clauses. So that we just want to know, for instance, do you think that the clause 2 in this particular case does capacitate the National Credit Regulator enough to do the job in the clause 1 or 2
from
there?
Right, we will slow down a wee bit, but maybe we can put that hand up of yours at any moment. Advocate, any moment?
Thank you, Chair. I will force myself to go slower. I tend to put the things in gear and then I move very fast. I will take that into account. So what we have in subsection 2, it is simply to say that the Chief Executive Officer or an employee appointed authorized by the CEO may appoint any suitable employee of the national regulator itself, or any person other than that employed by the state. So in other words, they could even look to other departments and ask for persons to be seconded as a debt intervention counsellor. So what will happen here is the National Credit Regulator, which at the time for people, so there will be an operational process where there will be this establishment created, there will be employees advertised, they will be recruited, and then those employees will be appointed as debt intervention counselors. Honourable Williams.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for that. I just want to know whether or not we realise how much work we could be giving to the National Credit Regulator if it is their job to declare that people are open debt. For instance, 9 million people could apply for this process, and I just want to know that we've got that covered. You know, we're saying that they can employ people to do this job, but I mean, they might have to employ, I don't know, 20,000 people to do this job. So I just want to know if we've got that covered, if we're not just making legislation that's never going to get implemented because we don't have the resources to do it. So I'm just worrying about that on this particular clause. Thank you, Chair.
Yes, I think the point is this was a great blog, but let us just get the CEO, Ms. Matsugari, just to come in here. Remember, this was raised last week, this particular issue, or the week before. Right. Thank you, Honourable Chair. You'll recall at the time when we presented our plan in terms of the resources required to implement the debt intervention program was to say that initially we may need about 70 debt intervention officers. Mm-hmm. And this particular provision also provides for the fact that we may also, you know, request officers to be seconded from other departments to assist initially. Thank you.
Right, I think that addresses it. I want to welcome other members who indicated that they would be late.
Somehow collapsed purely because we have been too rigid within the legislation. And then, of course, the entity complied and said, no, we have, because they don't want to look as if they're dragging their heels. So on the one hand, we say, yes, we've got a loop, but we mustn't make that statement recklessly. I think that is really what we're saying. We need to make it informed by the fact that there's limited state or limited fiscal budget available. So I noticed you spoke about other departments and so on. Well, I do hope all the departments are going to work together. I've already made my statement publicly on that. So it's going to require a real collegiate approach here, collective approach. But thank you for that. But take this into account. And I think the DDG should also be mindful of it. Right, Advocate Van der Merwe.
Thank you. If I may just respond to one thing, because I don't want to have members be under a disillusion or a misunderstanding on something. In this respect of outsourcing this function, the committee has in the past been very clear that they do not want outsourcing at all. So I have not provided for outsourcing. As it is worded at the moment, in fact, a debt counsellor could not be someone that is outsourced. Because it has to be an employee of the regulator. What they will be able to do is to outsource certain functions. They could outsource the data capturing. They could outsource certain assessments. But the actual interaction and the actual final assessment will have to be done by an employee of the regulator. Just so that is not... I don't want them to think that it would be possible, but it is in fact not.
No, thank you for that clarification, Honourable.
No. You know what point I said to you. I don't want you to say you are right or wrong. But remember, as members of the public, we hold different experiences. I'm not saying this thing out of misunderstanding. This sentence is very insulting. And it opens you up if you do something other than what is written there. And that's why I was saying, just look at it, it's an advice. Because you chose whatever reason to put certain things so detailed, like the mechanics, into law. Normally mechanics, you put them into regulations so that you don't bind yourself. Your duty is just to build sufficient capacity that they're able to do these things. That's the spirit of the law. The mechanics on how you build the capacity is either you build it internally, some kind of this kind of capacity requires technical know-how on certain things. Sometimes the capacity requires systems, because things they evolve. That's why government makes provision that in terms of capacity, can be internal capacity, you can bring a TSP, which is also allowed. But this one actually says an employee. An employee is defined in terms of our legislation. What does it mean? That's why I'm saying, I'm giving an advice. That's the attitude I've always taken, because I don't want to use my experience to impose certain things out in my other life as well. I'm saying, from the risk message point of view, we are going to have a difficulty. It's a good law, but this law is implementable. They are going to be in the understanding of the constraints we can do. Thank you.
I just want to perhaps say that all members are on board, and I have recognized your hand on it all my touch, but I think you're talking of, if I'm not mistaken, 2A, where it says that the National Police elect the regulator to do X and Y and Z, may appoint any suitable employee of the entity or any other suitable person employed by the state, etc. The concern that you're having is that this could be too tight a wording and may restrict the National Credit Regulator from employing sufficient people at a particular time. In other words, they wouldn't be there perhaps for years and years, permanent employees. but that they may be contracted over a particular time. But you have specified three areas. And I think, having said that, it will be up to the committee now. We've heard what the onboarding clause said, haven't we? And I'm sure we understand. So let us just comment on that with respect to this clause. Honourable Muntash?
Thank you, Chairperson. I hear what Honourable Mokhobo is saying, but I wanted to ask from the NCR the magnitude of their employee currently. Say, if by in 6 months' time would be the act is enacted, what would be your position in as far as human resources is concerned before we create our strategy? And I find comfort, Chairperson, in saying they may use employees from another country as well. Thank you.
Well, they're not going to respond to you. The Honourable Khadebe has got his hand, and you may want to come after that. Honourable Khadebe, Honourable Williams, and then Honourable Floor.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think the term "may" is actually a get out of whatever rigid prescription it might be. I want it to have been problematic if it was a mass employee. So it may. So it means that it provides some sort of flexibility. But what is also very important, Chair, I think that one of the things which I think is still outstanding on this page is the issue of the costing thereof. What is the financial implication to the state? Because we cannot prejudge what the state can and cannot do. The issue is the desirability of this bill. If this bill is desired to be implemented by, or to be passed by Parliament, it means that the state itself must be able to cost it up and much better. But what has happened, Chair, I don't think it has ever happened that the capacity is built overnight. The issue comes with the needs and the experiences. What the national credit regulator can do is that even before this thing can be asserted into law, they can go and look how much can it cost to implement, let's say, the first year of implementation, how much is it going to cost the second year, third year, so that we can have a certainty around that. But we cannot really move around saying that we still cannot afford to do that, because we can lend resources from other sources. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable
Khadebe.
Honourable Williams.
Thank you, Chair. I think I've been covered by Honourable Khadebe with the may point there that says may appoint.
Yeah.
But I'm also of the opinion that we must definitely try not to use external service providers here. In the main assessment of whether or not the person is over indebted, etc., it should be an in-house process. And I would really encourage that we don't use external consultants for that particular job, like the legislation says. So I think we are covered, and thank you, Chair.
Honourable McLaughlin?
Not that, Chair. I think taking to the two points that we would probably, by the time we come towards the end, normally we should not hold the legislation, but we just have to have a degree of comfort in terms of the capacity to implement. I think it's an important point that Honourable Khumalo were raising. Let's do it. You know, one of the things that has been our mistake over the last 24 years was to produce a plethora of legislation with no iota of understanding what does it mean to get it working. And probably this one is an important one. You don't want a legislation with so good intention, and the state does not actually have the necessary capacity. I don't want to get into the other dynamics. Probably the phased approach, because whoever put a legislation in mind have a sense of the magnitude of the assignment, even if you might not be 100%. Probably just give us a high level kind of assessment by the time it goes through the finalization, but without using that as an element to hold it back, but to use it as an element that we can push that more resources, because this is going to make a very definitive positive impact to these people that are better able.
Thank you very much, Honourable Matogo. I think one will also help us with what we have been saying all along, that there are certain aspects of the bill that will not be effective immediately. But having said that, I would hate that to be used as a reason to hold something up. All right. So we've made our points clear, the reservation, we're going to move on. Honourable, I mean, Advocate, Mr. Mervyn.
Thank you, Chair. If we're going to move to Clause 4, amending Section 27 of the Act, what the amendment here is purely just consequential because we are now giving additional functions to the regulator. So we also need to give these functions to make sure that the tribunal can actually execute. So Section 27 deals with functions of the tribunal, and what he's simply saying is that because the debt intervention will be a referral, it will not be an application, because you have this intervening regulator doing some evaluation, so it's just to say that there will be a referral and they are allowed to actually execute and do that. The next clause
yes,
five.
Thank you very much, Abigail Vandenberg. It's been drawn to my attention that I initially did say I wanted you to comment on Ms. Mostegari, the CEO of the NCR.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. A few things. When the Microfinance Regulatory Council, which was incorporated in the National Credit Regulator, was established, the MFRC was required to register credit providers. Now, because there were huge number of credit providers that needed to be registered, what the MFRC then did was that they appointed, in that particular instance, employees from audit firms to assist with the influx of applications that were coming in. But I can hear that honorable members, they would like to make sure that there's capacity built within the MCR, which means that over and above the new people that would have to be appointed, because MCR will have to be capacitated to deal with it, we would have to work very close with the DTI and get people from, the department to assist initially with the implementation of this bill. Currently, our staff complement is at about 155, so there's no way we are going to be able to do it without, employing more people into the organization, getting new offices, getting systems in place, and I think we did present a resource, allocation around this, and we indicated that initially we may need, 50 million rand to start off with, but that did not include officers that will be charged with the responsibility of providing financial literacy programs. So we may need, if we would have to be at a minimum 50 million to start with. Thank you.
All right, we are going to move on this point because the committee has made it clear what its concerns are. And these are the concerns that are attached to any new piece of legislation. But the degree is simply different here. It's great. Advocate Van der Merwe.
Thank you, Chief. And then it's called 5. This is Section 60 of the Act, and this section deals with the right to apply for credit. Now, it is a bit of an overkill to put it in here, but I wanted to make it very clear so that we don't have any loopholes that people try and apply to try and say, oh, but Section 60 allows me to apply for credit. Because remember, when you apply for the debt intervention measure, whether you go through a debt review process or whether you go through suspension, there is a period in which you're not allowed to apply for credit. So I'm making it very clear that statement is provided in this Act, meaning if we say that you can't apply for credit for a period, you can't use Section 60 to say, no, but I can. So that is simply what we're doing there. Clause 6. This inserts a new section into the Act. Now, initially, this was
part of Section 69, which deals with the National Register of Credit Agreement. This National Register is not yet operational. So the clause is the section is operational, but there is no register yet. And the regulator was concerned, and some of the members of the public were also concerned, that if we put it into the same section, that this register might go lost. So there was also a concern about this, if you call it a register, that it is simply open, everything that's in there must be open to the public. So we changed the word to record, and we simply said they must keep a record of these applications, both in the what the bill provides for and what may be prescribed, as well as the status of those applications and any orders granted. And then we made it very clear that this record may only be published either with the consent of the debt intervention applicant or if there is a requirement by law to provide for it. So if this act, for instance, says that the regulator must provide the credit bureau with information, then that is allowed. But let's say a minister prescribes certain things related to personal circumstances of the consumer to be kept, perhaps for future statistical purposes to look at the impact and so on. That information is not necessary to disclose to the public. It is confidential information, it might be personal information, so that will have to be by consent only that can be disclosed. So that is what this clause provides for. There will be a record that we can do the assessment, but we are protecting personal information.
No, I'm saying this one, I'm looking at the interpreter. Remember, it was one of the sensitive issues. Why not the question of accessibility to 5,000 terms of price? At least the why it is chaos is very helpful.
Yes, it is. Thank you,
Thank you, Chair. Clause 7. This amends Section 70 of the Principal Act. Section 70 deals with credit bureau information. So what we are simply providing for here is that credit bureau information, your consumer credit information rather, now also includes any information on an application form, status of, and orders granted in respect of debt intervention. So whenever the Act talks about consumer information, it will include that. And then we simply have in the next paragraph to say that when the National Credit Regulator provides credit consumer information to a credit bureau, the credit bureau must accept that without charge. So it will be something that is free of charge with the credit bureau.
Oh,
then we amend Section 71 in Clause 8.
We're going at a good pace for everyone.
Section 71 that we're amending here deals with the removal or of record of debt adjustment or judgment. So in other words, when a credit bureau must remove information. So what we are saying here, that if there is, and what I've done here is I've copied the section that deals with debt review. So whatever has not happened for a debt review, a consumer who is subject to debt review, will also happen in relation to a debt intervention applicant. So there will be a clearance certificate issued by the National Credit Regulator after certain things have happened. The same as with your debt review. If they have satisfied all the agreements or they have demonstrated financial ability to satisfy obligations and there are no arrears, and that all of the things under a rearrangement order has been settled in full. And then the regulator must submit a copy of that clearance certificate to registered credit bureau. If the National Credit Regulator for some reason fails or says I'm not going to issue this clearance certificate, then the debt intervention applicant may apply to the tribunal to review that decision. And if the tribunal is satisfied that the applicant should in fact have gotten that certificate, the tribunal may then order the regulator to issue the certificate, or let's say they have issued it but they failed to submit it, to submit it to the registered credit bureau. Now, just if I can just confirm two members, all these clauses that deal with the credit bureau information, I drafted and amended in consultation with the, or rather after consultation, because some of the things I did not accept, after consultation with the Credit Bureau Association. So we had a couple of to and fro with emails, where she would say, oh, but they have this. And I said, well, we can't do that. But in the end, we reached some sort of agreement where she would say, yes, they can, in fact, execute the way ADMI is drafted. Members will remember the Credit Bureau Association would say, some of these things will not be able to, they will not be able to execute. They are now confirmed that they will be able to execute as it stands. So that has been sorted. The next clause 9, deals with Section 71A of the Principal Act. 71A of the Principal Act deals with automatic removal of adverse consumer credit information. So what we are dealing with here is, now we are looking at the suspension orders and the extinction orders and a rehabilitation order. So we are saying that your regulator must submit proof of these orders within 2 business days to the relevant credit bureau. The credit bureau, and you'll see there on page 10, something in blue, it is just an oversight, it's a drafting error, the rehabilitation order must also be submitted. Then the credit bureau must remove a listing within 7 days. Now, we had some discussion about 7 business days versus 7 days, and what, in the end, the instruction to me was to go and look at the Act. So I looked at the Act in this specific clause. The specific clause does not use the word business day. It only uses the word day. So I've simply aligned it so that it's within 7 days. And that is the same period of time as for other things that have to be removed. So, subsection 3B simply indicates that the credit bureau must then remove that listing within 7 days from when they receive proof of a decision, or if there is a suspension, remember that your suspension goes further than your date of the order. Yes. So you can't have it within 7 days of the order, but the person is still under the suspension order. So the regulator must also indicate when will that suspension period end. So it could also be, if that is the later date, then it will be 7 days after that suspension period has ended, or the order of that suspension has changed. Then also, the other possibility, if there is a limitation on the right to apply for credit, it will be 7 days from that date. So the credit bureau will have to see whichever is the later date, whether it's the date of the order, the period of suspension, or the period of limitation. Whatever is the later, within 7 days from that date. But then 3C, you'll see it in blue, because we made provision for the rehabilitation as well. There might be a rehabilitation order during any of these periods, and then it must be within 7 days from that rehabilitation order. So even if the suspension date is later or whatever, doesn't matter anymore, the rehabilitation order trumps. Then 3D, the D in blue there, just because it's inserted 3C there. Now, what we have here is that if there is a dispute with the information that was now provided to these credit bureaus, with your normal debt review, a consumer may go to the regulator to resolve the dispute. But now the regulator is a party to the dispute, so they can't do it. So there was a bit of a discussion on how this should be handled. Should it be the minister? Should it be credit ombuds? And the decision in the end was that it should be the tribunal. And we then followed section 115 of the Act as a guide. So in other words, there is already established precedent for this. We have simply copied it and made certain amendments so that it fits with this specific clause. Then 3E then simply indicates that your credit providers must amend their affected credit agreement and submit that amended consumer information to a credit bureau. So what happens, and this is something that the Credit Bureau Association asks for, is it is not just sufficient for the regulator to submit information. Your credit providers submit information in an automated format almost. They feed information into it. So if your regulator and your provider is submitting 2 different sets of information, then there's some disjuncture in the bureau. So your credit providers, if an agreement is affected, must also make on their system the necessary changes so that the two talk to each other. So that was the rationale for that. Then if I can move to clause 10. So I'm now on page 11. So clause 10 inserts a new section into the Act, section 82A. This is the requirement of reporting on reckless credit agreement. Members will recall that we initially had both debt counsellors and credit providers to report, but there was a lot of criticism against that. In the end, the committee decided that it should only be debt counsellors that must report. Debt counsellors, however, had a concern that if they have to report on this, they need to get information. They don't have the information. It's not something that is just available. So we inserted something there in subsection 2. So sorry, subsection 1 simply deals that a debt counsellor must report, and they report to the regulator if they're not referring for debt review. But if they are referring for debt review, then they report to the magistrate's court. So there is an absolute requirement to report. The rationale is that your regulator deals only with those matters where there is in fact not a debt review going on before the magistrate's court. But where there is the magistrate's court considering the debt review, they must then consider the reckless agreement as well. Then subsection 2, we now provide that the credit provider must within 7 business days at a fee not exceeding the maximum prescribed fee, provide a debt counsellor with the following information in relation to the consumer concerned. Now this was one of the flag issues, and I think that we now have addressed it. So what we've done is, and you'll see there at the bottom, it struck through, such information as may be required to enable the debt counsellor. And there was a concern that that's a bit vague. What is such information? So the regulator pointed out that we could maybe use the word in the regulation that a credit provider must retain in order to show that they have done the affordability assessment. So we are now specifically listing that documentation. So it's the application for credit, pre-agreement statement, quote, credit agreement, the steps taken in terms of section 81.2, records of payments, and any debt of documentation in respect of steps taken after default. So I think that is much clearer. So that was the first flag issue. So perhaps let me just stop there for a moment, because it was a flag issue.
If I'm not mistaken, Honourable Charlie, you raised the issue.
Yeah.
Now, would you like to comment?
No, I'm happy with the way that you put it.
Yes, I think then, looking at everyone, we're all happy. Right, Honourable Kandebe.
Not sure. I'm on the subsection 4, the issue of the offence. I think we already discussed that actually it must be a jail term of the informant.
So, subsection 3 simply makes it clear the way in which the regulator will be able to deal with this report, because there's also a concern that the regulator is empowered to deal. So, credit providers and debt counsellors can say, but we report something, and the regulator just throws it back and says, we must go to the magistrate court. So, subsection 3 says that the regulator will deal with it as it is a complaint, and they must investigate it in terms of the relevant section. So, we are referring to existing sections in the Act, make it clear that they can then look at this report. Then
right.
The next issue is subsection
3. One moment, I think the Honourable McClure Board, I didn't see his hand just then, wanted to comment on something on 2. Is that correct?
No,
seven words.
You know what, I'm trying to go back this point in the before the fundamental issue. No, I'm serious. No, I'm just noting something. When Comrade Kumanichas came and sat next to me, he was showing me on the other side where he was saying 7 days. Then I'm checking in the document now because I'm looking at causes things. Now there's somewhere it appears 7 business, blah, 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 blah. I'm just saying when we do the cleaning up at a particular point, if these days are meaning the same thing, can we just be that's the only intention that I thought they think that we should be to put it in for you for your company.
No, we are completely agree, and that is an important point. Everything in alignment, so, you know, ensuring that if we talk about, that's just an example of one of the many alignments we need to ensure we pursue. But yes, you are on your issue here on the Kadebi. We're virtually there, are we not on four? And again, are we not just approaching four?
If I may just respond to the issue of the days, because it is a bit of a worry. I can't be consistent in the bill because the act is not consistent. So that makes it a bit of a problem. So we looked at it last time. What we have is in the act itself talks about section 2 interpretation, subsection 5. It talks about a number of business days and it tells you how to actually calculate that. So where I use days, when I'm inserting something into the act, something new, I'm simply using business days because that is what we have in section 2. But where I'm changing something in within a section, what I did was I went to look what that specific section is using. So for instance, the previous one was the credit bureau. I had it as business days. Then I went to look at the Act, and the Act actually says days in that specific section. So that's why I took the word business out, so that it's aligned with the rest of the section. So in other words, what I've done is, where I'm inserting in something new, I've used business day, but otherwise, if there is an existing section, I've aligned with the section.
May I, Advocate Brenda Merber, ask you to raise this with our state law advisor? This issue came up once before in finance about 11 years ago, about having to be confined to that principle act always. And I just forget what the response was from the then state law advisor, that, look, I mean, we've now learned and we've been able to appreciate that, look, we've got to stick with business days. You know, things evolve. Is there no way that we can, in an elegant manner, ensure that that is changed? Because in one sense, I would assume it is a technical amendment. I'm saying assume, because perhaps there was a specific reason to have said date and not business. Yes, Honourable McNaughton?
I think your first in your statement is very profound. If there is an ambiguity in the past, because it is in one legislation on the act, it doesn't have to continue to be that. We can't, you know, this thing ultimately they land in the hands of people that must adjudicate. And it then becomes subject to different interpretations. And you don't want to have such an ambiguity. And I think you've given a very clear guidance by the time we say we support the move. The issues of vagueness will have eliminated. It can't proceed. It's wrong. We understand that days means what in our home. In other words, it's always probably in the past, it's normally the business day. But we can't just leave it to subject to interpretation. And as democracy matures, our own interpretation of things must become much easier, user-friendly, even for people who don't understand law, to say what it means, so that we cannot actually say that, you know what, they say in law there is nothing called ignorance. Like, for example, you use powerful words, knowing it means, I can't say because I'm not learned there, it means that I feel I'm not sure, I check. I think Chairperson, it is a good directive. Let the, our team interact with the state law advisors. We don't want to have a bill that gets called to be interpreted on one issue.
Never mind. I think we will all agree
that
I can actually answer the question. There's two ways of dealing with it. We can correct that in this bill, but it will have to be advertised, and we will have to look at each specific clause, or each specific section, where the word days is used instead of business days, and to see what the rationale behind that is. The second option, and I am a bit worried, because there might be quite a number of places where that is the case, so it means, you know, we're opening it up for colleagues, etc. The other option is there is a bigger review of the Act underway, and that is perhaps something that the DGI must look at to put into their review. So that they deal with it at that stage and make sure that there is consistency with the wording.
No, I do agree with you, and that you will find out what you can, but that we talk to the DDG here. We're sitting here, Dr. Mitchell, if you may bear that in mind, and the National Credit Regulator as well.
Okay.
Thank you.
Let's move then. Thank you, Chair. Then we get now to subsection 4. Where the failure to comply with subsection 2, in other words, a credit provider did not supply or did not within 7 business days supply that information on request, and that is then made an offence. What I have done is I've not changed the sanction for it. I've not specifically provided for a sanction for it, so the general sanction in the Act will currently apply, because there wasn't really a discussion on it. So. Currently, that sanction is 12 months or a fine, and that is to be found in section 161. We must, however, if this is included, we will have to advertise this specific clause and get public comment on it. If I could just maybe, because I know some members weren't here in the last meeting, there was a question about the criteria around when something is an offence and when isn't it an offence.
Yes.
And I've explained that there isn't really hard and fast rules. It is about how serious something is and whether you want it to be an offence or not. And what I've done is to give the example of what we currently have, where we have unregistered credit providers, we have some prohibited action, people going to someone's house and not giving them the rights that they have in order, you know, that the Act provides for. And those prohibited conduct and so on are subject to an administrative fine currently.
Mm-hmm.
The problem, however, is that the committee is still receiving complaints of those things happening, and that is why we are making it an offence. So what I said to the committee is, if we decide the failure to give this information is serious enough, we can make it an offence from the outset. The other option is to say, well, look, this wasn't in the Act before. Let us first see how this goes. And we make it subject only to the administrative fine, which we then don't have to make any provision for, because it will be prohibited conduct and that will be covered. And then at a later stage it can be reviewed, and if you see that no, there is actually problems and people aren't providing the information, at that stage it can be made an offence. So those are the other two options.
Yes, could we just ask you to clarify something else so that Honourable Kandevi can then come again? So what I'm saying, Abigail, and remember, you know this issue, you've just raised it, depends really on X and Y, and it's entirely up to us, but why, you know, where if asking one to do something, and you're saying this continues to be flouted, specifically, what is the impact of this being flouted and not provided? What is the impact of that? This information.
Chair, if this information is not provided within 7 business days, what will happen is that the assessment of the debt counsellor will be delayed.
You see. And then, in short, relief won't be able to be made. So, now that we understand, Honourable Debbie, followed by the Honourable, I'm going to ask Chair there Honourable Williams, I would want you to come and last, having heard your colleague, Honourable Kadebe, Honourable Matlobo. Final point, Honourable Williams.
No, thank you, Chairperson. I think that this issue of making discriminatory offences is very critical, because if the death cutter cannot get this information, it was the very purpose of the act to bring about that. We can make an example, Chair. How many times were prescribed deaths sold to the other second level people? We know very well that after 3 years, the deaths were not paid to prescribe. But those guys, the principal, will really maybe sell that debt to the next person. So we can see that this thing is bad. It's already happening in the debt. So what is critical here, Chair, is that we must make it an offense, because we provided in the very same deal on the other side, we provided it as an offense for the consumer to provide the wrong information. We said it must be 4 months. So why must we be limited on the 24 mobile? And some of the credit providers, as I said, they make billions per annum. So if you are going to provide an administrative file, what is that going to make? Is that a meaningful question?
You see, unfortunately, we never had our focus. it's a serious matter, but there is also a legal issue that the advocate should just probably ask it. It's correct to make it an offense, but at the very same time, it will say, if for various reasons I can't comply within the prescribed time frame, because they could be found reasons. Do you want to ultimately say you are guilty, I choke you? Or you have some kind of something called reasonableness. You know, this is of things is decision, cogent, rational. And then after what kind of elasticity or tolerance level that you could tolerate before you actually think, no, now I draw the line. Well, I can't suffer from the fact that we did my children, because I thought you were going to go beyond Schedule 1. And 2 years still within Schedule 1.
Yeah.
If I had enough, I thought you wanted to go to Schedule 6. But not me to pretend you seem to be laughing.
Yeah.
This administrative inaction is in a serious intent. But the administrative inaction, whatever is meted against that contravention, which is an administrative action, must not be so severe that it found that it's not rational. But it must not be so inadequate that it does not actually serve as a deterrent. Because in other words, you want to strike the balance.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, having listened to the honourable members, I think that we must be very cautious about making an offence here. I'm not saying that there shouldn't be a high administrative fine, but I do also think that option two might be the best way, that we start off with the administrative fine. And if we find that these people continue to just not give the information, then we can create it, we can make it into an offence. I think that we should put that option in place, because we don't know how they are going to respond to this. But I think the instant that we pick up a trend that they're now undermining the whole process, then I think we can make it into an offence, and then we must be hectic with our offence then. So we give them a chance to implement, and if they fail to implement that, then we take action against them. Thank you.
Right, Honourable
Elwood. Thank you, Chairperson. I agree with Honourable Williams. I think that we must ask ourselves what would be the most effective measure to move the credit bureaus to cooperate. Usually, let's put it this way, you know, many people go to the police station nowadays to lodge matters, and many, you know, the police are overloaded, and many of those matters are administrative in nature, and this is sort of administrative in nature, and I don't think the police will have the will to actually follow up on this necessarily, because of the burden that they have to deal with with very serious crime, and not that this is not serious, but you know, all the other crimes like murder and bodily injuries and those type of things are the priorities, cash and transit heist and those type of things. So my sense is that credit bureaus operate on a financial basis, and that's what will hurt them if you get them in their pocket. So administrative fines would be a point of departure, and if they are then obstinate and they are actually trying to derail this process in terms of the act, then one can say, okay, there's an escalation of sorts where you can say, right, now it actually, there's clear evidence, and it actually there's a merit in the case to actually go to the police and open a case against them. Thank you.
So you support Honourable Williams' approach on that one, Honourable Kadebe. Oh, sorry, just before Honourable Kachani.
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, I mean, I think the key words here are in terms of our proportionality, effectiveness, and what and driving compliance. And in order to do that, I think we need to, like all these things, one needs to be cognizant of how best we get there. And that involves, generally in my experience, a mixture of character and stick. We're applying ourselves exclusively to the stick here, and I think we need to have some application to the carrot, because that's the secret lies in both measures. So I would encourage that.
Right, as we say, we don't confine ourselves.
It's
the broadness, then supporting the approach you
put forward on Honourable Williams, Honourable Kadebe. Well, it's just that the government is supposed to trust on other others, but the thing is that the credit provider, not just the credit bureau. And the credit providers are the ones which are handling that information, which they just like this argument issues. They must provide that information. What Honourable Masowa has said is that if a person is not going to comply with that, let's say within that 7 days, he must be able to indicate why he's not going to be able to do that. So if you show that that person is very ready, wants to comply, but the issue still is not his or her control has determined that he does not comply. But the issue of the speech share, the entire bill rests on this. If the information is not shared properly, it means that the process cannot continue in a proper way. So it means that if we just remain okay with this thing, with this one and a half, because if a credit provider, Murabot, is running a business of billions of shares, you speak about the administrative fine of 100,000.
Wait a minute. I just need to come in here. I may have misled you, and I don't want to do that. But this particular clause relates directly to the report and investigation of reckless credit agreement. I just want everyone to be certain about what we are talking about before we move on.
Honourable Masowa. No, I think just yourself and the comrades there, Hadem, we are asking that if we read this particular subsection 4, it must be read together with subsection 2. You know, we must never, this is an administrative action that can become so prejudicial. If it is this standard, because the issue is about the standard, we have just set a standard.
Yeah.
The standard is 7 days. Remember, this information is already available in there. Mm-hmm. It says within 7 days, retrieve the file, send me the file, so that the next other processes can be able to have it. Do you really say that if you are my credit provider, you can't give this information already with this thing? That's how had they will look at the matter in a very serious way.
Mm.
But I'm saying that in as much as it must remain an offense, like it has been proposed, It must be able to say if there is a failure to enter, if someone demonstrated it to say, let me say in a patient, to say, you know, I'm struggling for the following reason. I cannot be able to meet the surgeon day. This is why I'm there should be some kind of an administrative effort. If it has not been done, it is a failure. And a failure must be taken very seriously. It's not something that you're asking something that is out of the way. It's already something that is in the upside. But yes, it should be.
I want to move on, but this is a serious issue on Roman Tash.
I think what we need is a decision here. Let's go back to yourself. Do you want to come and before the advocate just clarify, please, Honourable Williams?
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I'm of the opinion that I understand how important it is that we put pressure on the credit provider in order to give this information. But I'm also of the opinion that, let's say, for instance, the credit provider doesn't give us the information, we make it an offence, and now it's a criminal offence. They'll end up in court for years and years and years, and the person and just that piece of information around one individual will now be stuck forever in court. And if they keep doing that, going to court, I think we should give them, and I hate doing this, as you all know, the benefit of the doubt to the private sector. But I will, in this case, give the benefit of the doubt to the private sector. And we can say to them that we will start with administrative fines, but if we see a trend where they start undermining this legislation, we will act decisively, and we will come up with even more hectic penalties in order to prevent that from happening. But I do think that we should give them the benefit of the doubt in the beginning, Chairperson. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. You know, to make it an offence doesn't in itself give create a force of push for them to comply, because to prove that you committed a misdemeanor in court, the standards are very high. So let's say the credit provider forgot about the request. They were just busy and their admin is in shambles. Right? This happens in the best of places in the world. So there's no intention there to commit an offence. They can never be convicted. So actually the offence then is not something that will motivate them to comply in that sense. I think that to get to that burden is very difficult in the first instance. So I think there should be a two-pronged approach where we see this as an administrative act that will have a sanction attached to it, that's a financial sanction, let's put it that way, that will hit their pockets. And only if they don't comply then, because I think when you get to the second part, if they don't comply with the administrative, after the administrative sanction has been imposed upon them, then you can actually argue there is an intention.
Yeah.
And then it's easier to prove that there is an offence. Thank you.
I want to just draw members' attention to something here that Michelle has drawn my attention to. Under the Consumer Protection Act of 2008, the Credit Act, but it's referred an administrative fine imposed in terms of this Act or the Consumer Protection Act of 2008. May not exceed the greater of 10% of the respondent's annual turnover during the preceding financial year, or 1 million. So it can be, I suppose if it was a multi-million operation, then 1 million then may be seen as close to petty cash. But I just thought I would, and then it gives the wording, when determining this, the following issues ought to be taken into account. So in the administration of the fine, of an administrative fine, there the gravity of the situation is taken into account, the behavior of the client is taken into account, and the market circumstances in which such a contravention took place. So all I'm saying is that we should be mindful of that while we discuss this. Now, you see what Honourable Munt, and I have recognized your hand, Honourable Williams, we spent 40 minutes or more on this at our last meeting. And I do understand that everyone sitting in this room of the committee wants this to be taken seriously. That is why we are having this discussion. But at the end of the day, there are two points of view on the table. The one is saying, you know what, we've seen this, it's going on and on, we need this as an offence. It's got to stop. That's the best way to stop it. Then we have another point of view, versions of the other point of view are that, well, yes, we could get to that. Why don't we start with the administrative fine and then move towards the offence? Now, I see members nodding that is generally what is on their table. Honourable Williams.
Thank you, Chair. Now, Chair, although the administrative fine might seem like a little amount of money, this 1 million rand to the big credit providers, but we must remember that they're only writing off 50,000 rand. So what we must ask is that is the big bank prepared, or whoever they are, prepared to spend a 1 million rand fine because they're not prepared to give information on a 50,000 rand debt? And I don't think they will be. That's very bad business. They won't stay in business for very long if they continue with that way of thinking. So I think that the administrative fine is enough. I mean, it's the 50,000 rand debt is the maximum that they can write off. So it's not like any more. Thank you.
Comment from the WIT, and that is why I'm saying last comment.
I think this can be of the administrative fine of the as it is. I think that provision is good, but there is one thing, this is also here. Yeah, that is that. Yeah, that's over or 1 million. Yeah, as it is. I think that, but there is one also provided. If a credit provider continues to do that, you must consider that it becomes an offense. Because the certain things which happen, let's say if there are systems like N, their computers or their IT is off, they might not be able to provide this at the speed which is required. But let us cancel it. The first one is the administrative part, but that part must be explicit.
I'd like the advocate just to come in here with a legal comment.
Thank you, Chief. If I could just point out to members that it is the greater of the 10% or 1 million. So in other words, 1 million is the minimum. So it could be a lot more than the 1 million. It is, strictly speaking, not necessary to say that the administrative fine is applicable because it is prohibited conduct, so it is provided, but it is also not wrong for me to add it. So I can just put in that there is an administrative fine or that it is prohibited conduct subject to that, that is subject to the administrative fine.
Right. The reason I'm... you know, we've got fresh teeth, I'm not mistaken. And in the past, I'm a great one for running tea breaks, but it has been brought to my attention by the health authorities, including the wellness campaign, which after 25 years is finally having an impact on me, that actually is very unhealthy for us to sit for 4 or 5 hours solidly. So on that caution we note, I'm looking at my time. It is now, my time is 10:15. We will resume in 5 to 7 minutes. By 5:25, we are starting again. Please. But we can't all rush there. I would very much like to see Advocate Van der Merwe. I'll come there if you feel like, you know, there's a chair next to you. All right.
I'm going to go to the next one. Yeah. Can you do anything with the